As You Wish Radio, James Gilliland's radio program. I am Brooks Agnew, guest hosting tonight, coming to you from an undisclosed location. Tonight with me here, I have a very special guest on James's behalf. I have Andrew Basciago. He was a childhood participant in a government program called Pegasus. And that we're going to talk about that tonight. Good evening, Andrew. How are you?
Good evening, Brooks. Good to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. Interesting program, Pegasus. I haven't done a lot of research on it because there isn't a lot out there on it. Can you give us a briefing about what Pegasus was, what time did it take place, and how did you participate?
Pegasus was a classified defense-related research and development program undertaken in the late 1960s and early 1970s by DARPA, which originally, of course, was ARPA. DARPA, of course, being the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Its purpose was to give the U.S. intelligence community capabilities that would allow remote sensing of time. And that is to say, quantum access. In other words, information on past and future events. Now, that information was gathered by two revolutionary technical advances that were classified as secret during the time that I served in Project Pegasus as a child and that remain secret today. The two leading technologies were a teleportation technology that was derived from the papers that Nikola Tesla left after his death in 1943 that allowed an individual to jump through an energy field and travel through a vortal tunnel in time-space and reach some other location in real time on the planet. And during the years that I was involved in Project Pegasus as a child, they had developed the ability to set the teleporter device so that they could set somebody forward or backward in time.
Now you're talking about sending a living, whole person through time through some kind of quantum access portal?
Correct. They were opening up vortal tunnels in time-space, and we were traveling through time-space to distant locations on the surface of the Earth. Initially, between a teleporter located at the old Curtis Wright facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, and the Santa Fe State Capitol grounds, which were being used as sort of a collection area that we were teleporting to. Then, after being involved in different activities in New Mexico, we would be transported by car to an identical teleport located at the Sandia National Labs adjacent to the Kirtland Air Force Base outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico. But let me say before we talk about the teleportation device at great length, another significant part of Project Pegasus were chronovisors that emerged in the work of two Vatican musicologists, Ernetti and Gemelli, who while studying the harmonic patterns in Gregorian chants, were developing a specialized microphone. And one day in their laboratory, something that Gemelli's father had said to him when he was a child came through the microphone. And Ernetti and Gemelli sought out the most distinguished Italian scientist of that time, which was the great Enrico Fermi. And by 1952, they had developed that technology into a device that they called the chronovisor, which was a device that propagated essentially holograms of past and future events. And so when I was brought into Pegasus as a child, as a seven-year-old, going on eight in the fall of 1969, they were involving us in project activities involving both of those technologies.
So while analyzing the sound patterns of the chants, I guess they wanted to develop a special microphone so that they could capture the tonal quality of human voices harmonizing in that way. They made a remarkable discovery, and they call in Enrico Fermi, and I think most of James's listeners know who Enrico Fermi was, definitely a pioneer physicist in the development of the Manhattan Project. So he gets involved in this project, and what happens?
Well, clearly, they just working with Fermi and their Italian team of scientists, they developed by 1952 essentially a screen, much like a television screen, on which they were bringing in past scenes of past events. So, for example, when I was brought into Pegasus officially in the fall of 1969 as a third grader, I was taken to a national security watch post in Flemington, New Jersey, and one of the technicians there showed us a circular screen that was about 8 inches across and revealed to us that it was producing real-time images of the signing of the U.S. Constitution. So we had the great opportunity to see George Washington and Benjamin Franklin as they appeared in life. I think the important thing to mention about Enrico Fermi is Enrico Fermi is, in fact, the great hidden figure in the history of time travel, because during the Manhattan Project, he became the mentor for Dr. Harold M. Agnew, who in the late 60s was the director of the W Division, the Weapons Division of the Los Alamos Labs, and had been Agnew's mentor at the University of Chicago during the Manhattan Project. So Fermi was involved both in the development of chronovision with Hernetti and Gemelli, and also the teleportation technology that derived from the works of Nikola Tesla. Because we know that the key hidden linkages in the history of time travel are the linkages between Nikola Tesla and the papers that he left at his death in 1943, teleportation, and the Los Alamos physicists. Because it was to Los Alamos that his papers were directed after they were seized by two War Department agents in 1943.
I was going to say, I would think that this would have very attractive military aspects to it. So sooner or later, the headwaters of all government funding seems to be weapons programs. So sooner or later, caught the interest of the right people. And how did they get involved?
Well, that actually is the sorry aspect of the hidden history of U.S. time travel research. The Philadelphia experiment was a cover story crafted by the Office of Naval Intelligence to conceal the fact that Tesla was the critical figure in the development of teleportation-based time travel. And after his work was forwarded to Los Alamos, the world-renowned physicists then gathering there to build the atomic bomb, time travel technology that would develop over the next 25 years under the aegis of the United States government was sequestered by the Defense Department. In other words, it had been weaponized, and it remains lodged to this day in the Weapons Division at the Los Alamos National Labs.
Mm. Well, now, you know, this raises a lot of questions, more than we could possibly cover in James's program here. By the way, you're listening to As You Wish Radio, and lest we get the phone lines, you know, filled with people, I will give you the toll-free number. It's 888-815-9756 if you'd like to call in and ask Andrew Basciago a question. But one of the questions that I had now is normally when this gets involved in the military programs, they begin drafting soldiers for the specific purpose of trying the new toy out. Were they successful in sending adult soldiers through this program?
Well, my late father, Raymond F. Basciago, was one of the project engineers. He was the liaison between the Ralph M. Parsons Company, which was the principal defense contractor involved in Project Pegasus, and the Central Intelligence Agency. And as my father explained to me before his death in 1990, the first individuals to teleport through this Tesla device, when we finally figured out that it was a teleporter, were three Navy enlisted personnel who expired. They asphyxiated as a result of the fact that the portal tunnel that was opened up by the teleporter was too long. They ran out of oxygen and sadly died. The next group of experimentees were a group of orphans from Latin America that our government was negotiating with the governments of different Latin American countries to bring up to the United States and involve in dangerous experimental defense research and development activities. And if they survived such tests, they would then be adopted into American households and be given the shelter and food and health care and so forth that all children deserve.
What a deal.
Yeah. I was in the third group of experimentees who were basically bright, healthy children from stable families that were brought into Project Pegasus for a number of reasons. First of all, as was revealed during our training and as I learned more with later discussions with my father, we were first brought into the project because we were experimentees. They wanted to test the effects of teleportation on children. So after we would teleport, in my case, from a teleporter that was located at the Curtis Wright facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, and arrived in the Santa Fe State Capitol Complex, they would confirm that all the kids had arrived. This was in summer of 1970 we began this activity. And we would then be bused to an old school site up in Laming, New Mexico, where we would be medically examined, you know, our blood pressure, our heart rate, and so forth. And then we would take several hours of standardized tests to gauge the impact of teleportation on our thought processes, on our mental functioning. So we were experimentees. We were also what I call necessities, in the sense that some of the devices would not work when adult human beings were involved. I expressly remember during my instruction that when adults would be placed in the holograms that the chronovisors were propagating, the hologram would frequently essentially blink out. It would become unstable and then blink out like a television set because the heartbeat and respiration and size of adults would essentially collapse the hologram. So they needed bright, cooperative human beings to use to discern what scenes were being of past events, for example, were being propagated by the holograms. So they made a decision to give specialized training to bright, cooperative school children like myself, who were then involved essentially as observers. We were participant observers in the scenes from the past and future that were being propagated by the holograms. They also told us during my training that we, as children, we were deemed to be tabula rasa. In other words, we didn't know what we were looking at, and so our perceptions of the scenes of past and future events that were being propagated in the holograms tended to be more accurate than the interpretations of adults would give to what they were seeing, because we had no prior background. We didn't have any expectations about what we were looking at. We were also clearly trainees, because we were told that after we spent our childhood in Project Pegasus, we would be decanted into the Naval Academy and then involved in a fully fledged program of time-space exploration that the United States government would have developed by the time we grew up. So we were expecting to go through the Naval Academy and then be involved in a time-space program to sort of rival the space program. And in that sense, we were young chrononauts. We were time-space cadets who would be expected to be the chrononauts when the U.S. time-space program became a fully-fledged program like the space program.
Now this sounds, of course, like a fully-fledged, you know, not just military operation, but it also sounds like it was a very plausible and advanced scientific event as well. So these children that participated in it, how many were there? Was it like a dozen or 100 or...
I was told during our training, and it was later confirmed by a CIA agent that I interviewed when I was doing my research on my experiences. So I spent about the last 10 years going back and gathering information from government insiders, making a number of fact-finding trips to New Mexico. There were 140 U.S. school children involved in Project Pegasus. In fact, there were 14 groups of 10. We were classified by different colors. So I was in blue team. In fact, I was the captain of blue team. So there were a cadre of 14 groups of 10 children. And these 10 children were all based at a given teleport in one location or another around the country.
So they didn't all operate out of the same location. They had multiple portals around the country by which they would make these jumps.
Correct. In fact, in the spring of 1971, when the defense attaché to Project Pegasus, Donald Rumsfeld, gave us sort of an introductory lecture that he described as a meet and greet in a subterranean briefing room at the Cerritos Cultural Center outside of Santa Fe. In fact, that amphitheater is still there. He told us that it was very important that we're involved in this project, and that he thanked us for our service on behalf of the country. And then he asked the kids around the room where we had teleported from, to New Mexico. And I remember that there were children there in that briefing from Pennsylvania, from Michigan, from Maine, and I remember stating that I was from New Jersey. So in some of the exercises, we were jumping to New Mexico in sort of drills that were staged to enable us to practice being teleported into a particular location, along with children who were teleporting from other teleports around the country.
Now, you're teleporting basically across distance in the same nation in the same time slot. Where you say you were also able to teleport not just across distance, but also across time. How did that work out?
Well, when we initially started teleporting, for example, when I first jumped to New Mexico from New Jersey with my father, so that we could drive from Santa Fe, so we could take part in a meeting with Dr. Agnew at the Los Alamos Labs, we were teleporting in real time. And so if it was 11 a.m. in New Jersey, we were arriving there at 9 a.m. in New Mexico time. But then during the summer of 1970, when I was teleporting very frequently to the state capitol complex in Santa Fe with the other group of children at my project location in New Jersey, we would spend the whole day there in New Mexico. Dusk would fall. We might be taken to dinner rather late, maybe 8, 9 o'clock at night. Nightfall would occur, or at least it would get rather dark in New Mexico. We would be driven to Sandia and jump through an identical device there back to the tarmac at Curtis Wright in Woodbridge, New Jersey. And we began to detect that they were setting us back in time because we were arriving, for example, back in New Jersey at 11 in the morning, the morning we had left. So we asked the project officials there, sort of the functionaries at Curtis Wright, "You're moving us back in time, aren't you?" And they kind of sheepishly acknowledged that they were. And in summer of 70 there, we asked them, "How far can you set somebody back in time?" And by then, they were able to set somebody back 12 hours, they told us.
Wow.
But then later, as I became more engrossed in the program and was sort of taken down the rabbit hole of advanced applications in quantum physics that the U.S. Defense Department was then gathering, I had a number of experiences where I teleported to New Mexico and spent long periods of time there. In fact, I spent 4 summers there during the 3 years between fall of 1969 and the summer of 72. And so they ultimately, before I left the program, they were able not only to allow us to stay for months in New Mexico before teleporting back to the afternoon of the day we had left, but they also on one occasion teleported us forward in time. From the fall of 1971 to the beginning of the summer of 1973 in New Mexico.
Now, did they have a mission in mind, or were they just sending you a certain distance into the future? Hopefully, sending you that far into the future, they knew that there would be a portal for you to get back through.
Right. They told us that the primary purpose for Project Pegasus is what they were calling remote sensing in time. In fact, they had us read this mimeograph technical paper, dark art technical paper, entitled Remote Sensing in Time. So fundamentally, Project Pegasus was a classified R&D project in furtherance of the intelligence gathering functions of the U.S. government. And it was going to allow the executive branch, and of course the intelligence community that serves the executive and the president, for example, to have prior information of future events and also better information about past events, primarily so that they could engage in logistical planning for future events.
So they must have had some kind of protocol. For instance, we're not going to send you 2 years into the future so we know what the stock market's going to be doing, or 2 years into the future to know what some other country is going to be doing militaristically so we can go back in the past and prevent it from happening. There had to be some kind of protocol written.
And in fact, we were sworn to secrecy as children, of course. We lacked the capacity to contract, so those secrecy oaths were not legally valid. But I do remember at that National Security Watch post at Flemington, it was explained to us that Project Insiders were essentially sworn not to take advantage of any of the future information that they came into, for example, by speculating on the stock market. Another thing I'm certain of is that during the downtime in New Mexico, where, for example, I would share lunch or dinner with my father and some of the engineers from Parsons, and maybe somebody like Dr. Harold Agnew from LANL. I remember meeting Dr. Ivan Browning of the CIA in that context. There was a pretty robust discussion, philosophically speaking, of whether or not the U.S. government would involve itself in trying to alter future events as a result of using quantum access devices of this kind to access information regarding future events. And the Project Insiders were pretty much unanimous in believing that they shouldn't play God and that they should only engage in contingency planning regarding future events rather than trying to alter future events in light of the information from the future that they were collecting.
Sort of like having the Band-Aids ready, but not really going in and trying to prevent the fall from happening.
Right, that was a philosophical consideration. In fact, individuals in the project who were urging quantum engineering, that is changing the future as a result of prior knowledge of it, were pretty much being scorned by most of the project insiders. They definitely wanted to keep their hands off the future. Another concern clearly was practical. If you act in the present to change your future event that you know about, let's say a mega event like 9/11, you can certainly alter the destiny of the human race. The problem is that when you do that, when you effectively try to divert, let's say a mega event, a very serious event in the future, you diminish the quality of all of the forward intelligence that you gathered from that point forward.
Sure.
Because changing the mega event changes all of the outcomes that are a result of that mega event. So I think this discussion is relevant to 9/11 because I know they had prior knowledge of the events of 9/11 because it was at the Aerojet Corporation facility that once existed in Socorro, New Mexico, which was processing some of the images from the future that we, in fact, were sent forward in time to collect, that they were processing images from the future. And I know to a personal certainty that that included about an 18 or 20 second film loop, one of the planes hitting one of the Twin Towers on 9/11. So they did have information about critical events like that, but I know that the project pretty much decided that it would be an impractical approach to try to alter future events because then they would have to endeavor to reconstruct their intelligence database regarding all of the future events after that point. So certainly when I was on the project, there had been a decision that they would not try to intervene and play God and alter future events.
Well, for sure, at least you knew what information that you've been able to recover that you accessed. But with more than 100 other young people participating in the program, who were also bright, well-trained, pretty well-disciplined young people, they probably had a pretty good stream of intelligence data coming in. I guess my next question would be, since they were able to teleport on this planet, was there the possibility of being able to look at or even teleport to other planets?
Well, when I was in the project as a child in the late 60s and early 1970s, all of the teleporting we did was on the face of planet Earth, and it involved both teleporting to the past and to the future. In fact, there was a device called a Stargate device that later appeared, the term that appeared later in popular media, that we used to access the year 2045 to bring microfilmed data scrolls back to the present. These were summaries of future events between 1970 and 2045 that project historians in the future were writing and that we were actually bringing back in microfilm form. But certainly when I was on the project as a child, there was no discussion of teleporting off planet. But in 1981, as a result of being familiar with the physiological, mental aspects of teleporting, I was asked by the CIA to teleport to Mars. And I did so several times in the summer of 1981 from a jump room located at a CIA facility in El Segundo, California. So another significant aspect of my experience is that I can confirm that by the early 1980s, we were, in fact, teleporting individuals off planet.
Now, this is so amazing because we get a steady stream of what we think is very high-quality science fiction which feeds our cable channels like the Science Channel, feeds our feature films with plenty of mind-stimulating time travel and really leading-edge scientific ideas relating to ETs and off-worlders and UFOs and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm stunned at the genius of it, that they would use science fiction as a popular outlet for disinformation, so that if any of this ever did leak out, you know, they could just say, oh, you mean like the popular television program? Are you crazy?
Right, that's a good point that you make, Brooks. In fact, science fiction, as we understand it, is essentially a literary genre that was created by the U.S. intelligence community to place data regarding black projects like the one I was involved in childhood and then later, essentially to be able to point to the fiction and say, oh, well, that can't be science fact because that's something that person just derived from the science fiction literature. We know, for example, that Sir Arthur C. Clarke and Robert A. Heinlein, two of the most renowned science fiction writers in the latter half of the 20th century, had desks adjacent to each other at British intelligence during World War II. I also know from my experiences that they were clearly dropping technical concepts into popular culture that provided a form of the technical proficiencies that were then under development, but that really misled the public as to what was going on. The clearest example here is the fact that when teleportation-based time travel emerged during the 1967-68 time frame and was fully operational and Defense Department insiders were beginning to experience teleporting between distant places on Earth, they introduced a concept through the popular TV program Star Trek in which teleportation was achieved by disintegrating the individual and then reassembling them at the destination. In fact, the opposite was occurring inside the actual U.S. government project in teleportation at that time. The device was, in fact, opening up a vortal tunnel in time-space through which the time traveler, the teleportee, if you will, was jumping through time-space to a distant location. So, in fact, it was the opposite of the form of teleportation that became so popularly known as a result of Star Trek.
So you weren't taking someone's molecules and scattering them all across space and reassembling them on the other side of the universe. You were literally taking the person in good health with good training and the air immediately around their body and putting them through a tunnel. So the air they have with them is all they've got, right?
Exactly. They were using a form of radiant energy that's inherent in the universe that Nikola Tesla discovered that among its properties had the ability to bend time-space. And they were using that radiant energy field so that when an individual jumped through the energy field between these two parentheses-shaped objects that were the armatures of the teleporter, a vortal tunnel opened up, an actual interstitial chasm in the fabric of time-space opened up, and the teleportee passed through it. We were never altered biologically by being disintegrated. But I should say that it was a dangerous and experimental technology that was not entirely safe. Because one time, when I was involved in an exercise in which children were teleporting from different locations around the country and arriving in the state capitol grounds there in Santa Fe, I ran past a public fountain between two buildings, and there was a child about my age, about 9 years old, writhing on the ground, and was already one of the adult team leaders was holding him to the ground. And two female team leaders were on their feet, and they were talking quickly into their walkie-talkies. And the boy was writhing on the ground, screaming, my feet, I'm only 9 years old. What am I going to do without any feet? Because what had happened, as I discovered when I ran past the fountain, is that he had popped into view in Santa Fe standing in about 3 inches of water that had collected in this public fountain, either because it had rained there or the fountain had been leaking. And as a result, his feet arrived slightly later, and he slid off his ankles just like a block of ice slides off another block of ice. And when I ran past the fountain and realized that he didn't have any feet, that his ankles looked like they'd been cut off, cut by a bandsaw, as it were, I looked into the fountain and I could see his red kid sneakers and his feet sitting in the fountain. So there were mishaps like this. This was a dangerous experimental federal research project, and it wasn't entirely safe when we began teleporting.
Absolutely fascinating. This is As You Wish Radio, James Gilliland's weekly radio program, and I'm Brooks Agnew, guest hosting it tonight for him. You can call in toll-free, 888-815-9756, if you want to be on the program. Andrew Basciago is my guest, and we are talking about the Pegasus Project. You mentioned a few minutes ago that you made a couple of jumps to Mars. The scientific community has led us to believe that there's almost no atmosphere on Mars. It's difficult to breathe, that there's no life on Mars. What did you learn when you went to Mars?
I first went up there from the jump room at the CIA facility in El Segundo by myself. And I was told that I would arrive in an underground location and then walk up a concrete stairway into an area behind a head or skull on the surface of the planet. Mars is littered with essentially statues of human and animal heads, skulls, faces, and masks. And these serve as markers for the apertures to the underground civilization there that are clearly visible to intelligent humanoids, but that animals have great, many of which on the surface of Mars are predators, have difficulty discerning as hallmarks of access points to the underground civilization on Mars. And so I jumped to an underground location on Mars and then walked up the stairwell and had been instructed to step out of the eye sockets of this skull-like construction on the surface of Mars. And there were several human beings standing around there who did not have specialized breathing equipment. I was still in a crystal helmet with a respiration capability on it. And it was very hot and very stiflingly stale air. There seemed to be very little oxygen in the Martian atmosphere. It kind of felt like when you try to breathe at about 10,000 feet. And I was pointing to my helmet saying, "Oh, can I take this off? I'd like to try to breathe the Martian atmosphere." And the individual there signaled to me that I could. And I removed my helmet and I was able to breathe in the Martian atmosphere. So there's clearly enough oxygen on Mars to sustain ordinary human respiration.
So it's just like very high altitude Earth, like maybe 18,000 feet. Difficult to breathe, but not
possible. Definitely. During the two trips that I did to Mars, I experienced a very labored breathing like you do when you're hiking at a high altitude.
Interesting. So what was the surface like? You know, was it red and dusty and freezing cold, or was it what color?
Mars is a very beautiful planet. I think it most closely resembles, let's say, the area around Sedona, Arizona. There's primarily a rust-red soil, but there are also patches, very beautiful patches of ochre-colored soil. The rocks on Mars are not just red or rust-colored. They're very beautiful. Dark turquoise is a very common color of the rocks on Mars. There are reds, greens. Part of the Mars cover-up by NASA has been altering the color of the data that they're collecting on Mars to perpetuate the myth that Mars is a red planet. In fact, it's a multicolored planet, quite a beautiful one at that.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned that you popped into an underground facility. Are we to understand that the bulk of the quote-unquote Martian intelligent life lives inside the planet instead of on the planet?
Yes, in fact, 4 days after my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, was published in 2008, I was contacted by a senior case officer from the CIA, and she confirmed that my paper was on target, and there's a civilization of about a million humanoids of several different types living in the primarily underground civilization on Mars.
Now, are these all native Martians, or are they from other planets? Are some of them very similar to us? Or?
Yeah, the Martians include several typologies of humanoids. There's a race of beings that are essentially our genetic cousins, who we haven't had very much contact with since the solar system catastrophe of 9500 BC. Where we believe debris elements from the Vela supernova explosion entered our solar system and destroyed a planet where mathematics shows a planet should be, namely the location of the present asteroid belt, creating the asteroid belt, and also hammered Mars very severely, fracturing Mars into sort of an oblate spheroid. And debris from that catastrophe also struck the Earth and essentially eclipsed the great maritime civilization that built the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. So we're actually in the survivor civilization of that solar system catastrophe. Civilization really wouldn't reinvigorate itself until around 3000 BC in ancient Sumer. We now know from the archaeological evidence, not just on this planet, but even some of the archaeological evidence that I found in NASA's photographs from the west valley of the Columbia Basin of the Gusev crater of Mars, that there are artifacts that link Mars to the ancient Egyptian civilization.
Wow.
Prior researchers, obviously DiPietro and Molinar, when they found the face on Mars and the surrounding pyramid structure, and also discoveries made by figures like Richard Hoagland and the late Dr. Tom Van Flandren, have established pyramidal structures on Mars. But in furtherance of establishing this linkage between ancient Egypt and ancient Mars, I found Egyptian artifacts on Mars in the form, for example, of a sarcophagus of a king that has a conical hat that's identical to the one that is worn by Queen Nefertiti in the iconic bust of hers, that the German archaeologist Ludwig Borchardt found in Amarna, Egypt in 1912. So one of the exciting things about the discoveries that I'm now making on the surface of Mars by analyzing NASA's own data is that in some locations on the Martian surface, we're finding Egyptian artifacts. And that helps establish the ancient connection between Egypt and Mars when there was an interplanetary federation linking the planets in our solar system.
Absolutely fascinating. By the way, for those of you that want to read up on this, there is a book out. It's Bayer Publishing, I believe. It's called Cataclysm, 9500 B.C., the day the Earth nearly died. It's authored by geologist and paleobotanist Alan N. Dallaire. And it's a little dry of a read, but the evidence is there all over Earth that does confirm this 9500 cosmic event that occurred. Something huge, it appears, passed through our solar system and had cataclysmic effects on both planets, which almost wiped out life on Earth. It's taken us a long time to recover from that. So this is so fascinating. I could spend all night long and all day talking about this, Andrew. The other participants in the program, was this a program that was terminated, or did they continue to bring young people into it as time went on? Do you know if the program was mothballed or taken even deeper into black projects in the military?
Right. Well, we know that there's no evidence from my experiences as a child in the program in the late 60s and 70s that the project was ever terminated. We also have the fact that by 1981, they were used in teleportation to place time-space explorers on the surface of Mars. So from that, we can extrapolate that long after I left the project in a substantial way, I was involved in a substantial way in the project, there was project continuity. But I'd like to point out, when I talk about my experiences in Pegasus, that we were teleporting between Jersey and New Mexico with adjustments in time 40 years ago.
Wow.
And so one can, I mean, if the same technical development processes remained in place, one can't even fathom the level of technical development that the United States government has actually achieved secretly, and that as a voice in the disclosure movement, I'm trying to bring pressure on that issue and emphasize the fact that we can evolve properly as a civilization if this kind of advanced technical information is sequestered within the cult of intelligence. We have to release this information. We have to establish an amnesty program for government insiders to come forward and tell the truth to the American people and the people of the world about the different advanced technical projects that they've been involved in whatever capacity, so we can simply harmonize the capabilities that the black world, the world of the cryptocracy, of the permanent secret government, has achieved, and then allow all of the people of the world to know that these technical proficiencies have already been achieved, are being used by the U.S. government to perform quantum access and discern information about the future, for example, either by sending individuals to the future and bringing artifacts and information back, or by, for example, using the chronovisors to propagate holograms of past and future events. This is information that the American people paid for and that everybody on planet Earth has a right to know, because I believe that as part of the natural heritage of humankind, human beings have a right to know about the true natural history of our solar system and also about the true state of technical development by our civilization on Earth.
Well, I would think that level of information, we do have a right to know it, but, you know, it gets to the point where if you release that kind of information, somebody somewhere is going to say, wait a minute, how did you know that? And if you know that, what else do you know that's going on out there? Our listeners might ask the question like, gee, in the 60s, we were still using vacuum tubes and 2-inch tape. And today, we have microprocessors that can process 2 gigacycles of technical data. We have the internet. We've got unbelievable leaps in technology. About every 4 years, we seem to be doubling our capacity. It would seem almost beyond the realm of imagination that we would be able to resist such a temptation to take this technology to the next level. And the next, what's to stop us from going beyond Mars and maybe to other M-class planets with other civilizations who have reached similar levels of technology? And one more question would be, did we reverse engineer alien technology, or did this come strictly from the mind of Nikola Tesla?
Well, that's often suggested, that because this technology was so advanced, it was reverse engineered from crashed alien vehicles on Earth. I know, based on having served in Pegasus as a child, that I think a proper view of it is that in these kinds of black projects, they had a funnel, rather a large funnel, into which they were putting whatever information they thought would be of value to the technical goals that they had set for themselves. So, for example, in the teleportation project, I remember my dad mentioned one time when we were sharing lunch in Old Town Albuquerque when we were on the project, that, quote-unquote, most of what we're doing in the project derives from the works of Nikola Tesla. But we also know that they were putting in an intelligence funnel the developments achieved by other researchers in the United States and elsewhere, certainly by whatever information we could gather was being achieved by Soviet researchers, anything that we could derive from particularly interesting archaeological artifacts that provided schematics of advanced technology, and also off-planet information, information back engineered from, for example, downed extraterrestrial time spacecraft. So I think a proper view of the hidden history of the U.S. time travel program is that the principal technologies derived, first the teleportation technology from Tesla, and then the chronovision technology from Rinetti and Gemelli, but that there was an active search for more information from other sources. But I don't think that it's true to say that teleportation was achieved as a result of reverse engineering alien craft. I think it's more accurate to say that the next century of technical development in the United States and elsewhere, we owe a debt of gratitude to Nikola Tesla for having pioneered.
Wow. Well, he was certainly a man ahead of his time, definitely a Renaissance man, responsible for launching empires such as Edison and Westinghouse. And had he been well-funded enough, probably would have solved the energy crisis we are now facing. Unfortunately, he was pitted against the oil giants who wanted to take that to the next level.
Well, one thing I can say about Tesla, I remember from the project, during our training for the project, is that Tesla's papers were never lost. That's essentially a conceit in the alternative media. Tesla's papers were seized by 2 War Department agents, and they were forwarded to the Los Alamos physicists, who were then gathering in New Mexico to build the atomic bomb. And that's essentially a hidden history of time travel. You need a particular security classification to visit the Los Alamos National Labs and access Nikola Tesla's papers. So his papers were never lost. They've been in Los Alamos since 1943.
Andrew, we have about 6 minutes left, and we have a caller on line 1. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
This is Jehala. I'm calling from Tennessee.
Oh, yes. Welcome to the program.
Hey, what an interesting show tonight.
Oh, I know.
Wow. I have some questions.
Well, hurry up.
Is this part of the looking glass technology that Dan Burrish speaks about? That allows you to do these, go into these jump rooms?
I think most definitely it is. As a child participant in Project Pegasus in the late 60s and early 70s, however, I can confirm that the term looking glass was never used back when I was on the project. The devices were called chronovisors and were always called chronovisors. That is to say, this so-called looking glass technology. I believe that term owes to some investigative journalism that Dr. Richard Boylan did that was quite accurate, that looking, quote-unquote, looking glass technology.
It sounds like what someone would call it, looking from the outside in. That does maybe not a code name, but maybe an outside observer's name for it. Does that answer your question, Jehala?
Somewhat. Now, and I also understand that because it was messing with the time continuum for different timelines and stuff, that they have dismantled all of these looking glass technologies.
That chronovision created energy fields that were so dense that they somehow warped the time-space continuum is an idea that emerged in Project Camelot's reporting about the experiences of individuals like Dan Burch. Mm-hmm. And my position on that is that they weren't powerful enough to do that. They were effectuating the holograms that the chronovisors were producing and also the teleportation capability with relatively low inputs of energy. I think it's more accurate to say that when you've undergone quantum displacement as a result of Tesla-based teleportation or Ernetti-based chronovision, you experience a change of your universe, because as the percipient of your own experiences, you are frequently shifted slightly into a slightly alternate timeline. So I don't think it had the damaging effect that's been reported by some sources. I think it did the most damage to the individuals involved, because they were always coming back to a slightly changed present.
Okay. Have you been interviewed by Camelot?
Have you been interviewed by Camelot?
Camelot? But I know Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy quite well. They're wonderful people, and I'm going to be interviewed by them for several hours on their upcoming radio program on American Freedom Radio. So
I listen to them every week, yes. Okay. Now my next question is, why now are you coming forward?
Why now are you coming forward?
Why now?
I'm coming forward now because I'm concerned that the advanced technologies that remain secret in the possession of the U.S. and other world governments may become part of the solution set. In evolutionary terms, they may be needed in the coming decades as we confront the crisis of environment and development. For example, my father was committed to the notion that teleportation should be explored as a civilian transportation technology. So I believe that the people of our planet not only have a right to this information, but in coming years may have a need for this information. And therefore, I'm coming forward at this time to help bring about those positive developments.
Excellent question, Jehala. Thank you. Rob, on line two, you're on the program.
Missed it, but could you shed any specifics or shed any light on the upcoming events and around 2012?
Upcoming events.
If you have any insight as far as that frame and, what we might...
There was an experience that I had with Project Pegasus that may relate to the 2012 literature and the expectation that there may be some sort of planetary catastrophe at that time. I took part in a probe to the year 2013 on November 5th of 1971 from a chronovisor that was situated at the ITT Defense Communications Facility in Nutley, New Jersey. In fact, the energy field that was propagated by that chronovisor was so intense and so bright that we wore specialized equipment in terms of a metal-coated jumpsuit and a crystal helmet, and we were sent forward in time in this form of technical remote viewing to examine the condition of the U.S. Supreme Court building on the Mall in Washington, D.C., as it would appear in the year 2013. And after I was brought back, it took off the spacesuit and poured out my boots from the perspiration that had gathered in them, and I was walked down the hall for an interview, for a debriefing, undertaken by a lieutenant commander for the U.S. Navy assigned to the Operation Naval Intelligence. I told the naval briefing officer what I had seen during the probe to the future of 2013, and that was that the U.S. Supreme Court building on the Mall in Washington, D.C., was under about 100 feet of brackish water. And the Navy officer who was debriefing me became quite consternated. He got up and started smoking. He actually spilled ice water on his desk that he was serving me. So I can confirm that on one possible timeline that we may confront, there may be a catastrophe that will seriously jeopardize the east coast of the United States, that is to say, inundated under a large amount of water. We never detected or knew what that event was. In fact, we don't even know if that is an inevitable event, because we know that when they were performing these time probes, they were frequently accessing alternate timelines in the multiverse. In fact, I was involved in a set of chronovisor probes in New Mexico during one of the summers that I teleported there and spent time there and then teleported back to the beginning of the summer in New Jersey, in which they established that multiverse exists, because every time they sent the same child or another child to the same past event, it changed a little bit. So I think we have to be mindful about what we're doing to our planetary ecology, but I don't believe that my experiences in Pegasus establish that necessarily we have to confront some sort of planetary cataclysm in 2012. Certainly on that timeline, however, we did, via technical remote viewing, establish that Washington, D.C. was under about 100 feet of brackish fresh water.
Well, Rob, they don't call it foggy bottom for nothing.
That's right. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for the phone call. And listeners, thank you for dropping in to As You Wish Radio, James Gilliland's weekly radio program, 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock Pacific Time. I'm Brookside, new guest hosting for James from an undisclosed location. My guest tonight, Andrew Bishago. I'm sure we'll be hearing more from him. This is Brookside News signing off.